It is time for the Media Beat with David Terachuk. David joins us on a Friday morning. We rebroadcast it on the weekend, also during our news block during the next week. I do believe it's Monday, as a matter of fact. David, of course, you can find him at his own website, themediabeat.us. He's also a PBS television correspondent reporting on ethics and belief. And we once again say good morning to David this morning. Good morning, David.
It's good to be with you live from the media capital of the world. Hi, how are you?
Well, there's a lot of different answers to that question, David.
I can imagine.
You know, we have such a plethora of stories that we can hit on, and they're all world stories, and they're all tied in, of course, with the administration. First, I really have to get your thinking about the Democratic National Committee as they dreamed up a plan to help stop the Bernie Sanders campaign by allowing Mr. Bloomberg in, even though they changed the debate rules to do that. And after one appearance, they realize what a big mistake this is, because it doesn't look like he's going to do what he thought they would do, which is get rid of a couple of the other moderates. They've just added another moderate into the mix, and it's going to be a wild next week and a half as we go through Nevada, South Carolina, and then to Super Tuesday, where the DNC, for some reason, on one day, decided to put up fully one-third of all the available delegates.
Yeah, it's a most intriguing scenario, especially if you if you see it through the lens that you're offering us now, that the DNC is responsible itself for so much of this. Am I going to call it chaos? I'm certainly going to call it a confused situation to read. I was at a social gathering the other day, and I'm quite used to people that I'm happy to meet. They're wonderful, ordinary, decent civilians, as it were, who, when they ask me what I do for a living, very often they say, "Oh, that's interesting. You must have a very exciting kind of life." And most times I say, well, it's like any job. It can be exciting at times, but other times it's just kind of dreary, or at least it's got a humdrum aspect. But I have to say that someone said something to me at this most recent gathering and said, it was almost like a tone of condolence. I said, I'm a journalist, and said, oh, I really feel sorry for you. and sure, I can understand. And he went on to say that it must be very dispiriting reporting on so much mess and confusion and generally dispiriting matters. And I couldn't help but agree. And this week is a particularly pointed example. I kept pinching myself and wondering, you know, what country am I in? It seemed to me that everything was piling in on us. The upcoming, very imminent caucuses of Nevada being the pointed end of this. The Democratic Party trying to take its proper democratic steps towards nominating a leader who is intended to depose, or at least replace in proper democratic fashion, a national leader they want to get rid of, the chief executive. But at the same time, we're confronted with a situation that it seems to make me think, anyway, of a caricature of a banana republic. We get that same chief executive throwing a fit because his own intelligence services are briefing the National Assembly, in this case the U.S. House of Representatives, that a foreign power is interfering with our election process, and he doesn't want it known. He's furious that the report would have been made to our elected members, and is now curiously demanding why he wasn't told himself. Well, his own record on hearing things about Russia is enough to explain why an intelligence officer briefing her bosses or the people who had oversight over her and her work. I'm talking about Shelby Pearson, the aide to the director of National Intelligence, who, by the way, is being replaced by the president's choice, who happens to be a full-time ambassador at the same time, a political appointee, of course, not a career diplomat. And meantime, against this backdrop, you do have the Democrats themselves desperate to effectively put an end to this strange administration. Strange and allegedly deeply corrupt administration, just as it in the best ways it can, and they turn out to be, as you say, the shambles that's emerging around this latest stage, the Nevada caucuses, and indeed the appearance into the field of a non-politician, as it were, who has happened to be the mayor of my own hometown, but not really a Democrat, not really a Republican either. But it has that messy look of a country that does not know how to rule itself, how to conduct itself as a political entity. And it is profoundly dispiriting, I have to admit, to my social gathering peer. And I think you can see it too. I notice your reporting has got that weary sense of what a mess we're in, and I can't blame you for that.
You know, I look at this and I look at it, all ties together. We have a president whose top six advisors, some have been with him for over 30 years, all convicted. You have a president who does not want to hear bad news. So in major positions like security, he puts in somebody that won't pass along that news. On top of that,
the emperor has no clothes.
Yeah.
No one dare say so. It's a caricature of a banana republic.
And you add to that the party that is trying to unseat the president set up rules, decided to break their own rules, but because Bernie Sanders played by those rules, and Bernie Sanders doesn't accept outside super PAC money and relies on 5 million people a month to give him $27 or $18 a month, the man can raise $25 million to $30 million a month. He has played by the rules this year and is in a position right now, a good position. Of course, we'll have to see what happens at the end of Super Tuesday. But the Democratic Party changes its own rules, which should really upset the heck out of everybody who dropped out because they couldn't meet all the stringent rules. You have that to look upon at the same time as the president is fumbling around. And I want to ask you a question about Boris Johnson's victory over the Labour Party. Michael Bloomberg and a lot of the...
Just to switch countries for the sake of variation.
Yeah.
But I think we find a very similar situation, reminding us again of a caricature of Banana Republic. Yeah, my old home country is no better than my new country, it seems.
Yeah, and what's interesting, I want to ask you this question. Michael Bloomberg, the moderate Democrats, the DNC, all comparing Bernie Sanders to what happened in England. I just want to ask one question. In England, did the Labour Party at all in that quickly called election ever lead in any polls? I look at all the different polls, and I don't take them as
no,
sure
universally
fact.
They were predicting a Labour defeat, yeah. And with varying degrees of confidence and indeed the size of the lead that was being predicted. But yeah, sure, it was no surprise. I mean, they did not conduct a very good campaign. They did not have a unified position for a start on the central issue that had brought about the election in the first place. The Labour Party was neither pro-Brexit nor anti-Brexit, and that was, I think, the fundamental flaw at the heart of any attempt to deal with the British mess of politics at the moment. The British variation on you know what seems to be a general sort of confusion in the political body of just about every advanced nation now. And yes, you can't really make a parallel with well, there are certain ways in which you can make parallels between the countries, but not in this matter of the preparedness of the Democrat. You're citing the preparedness of the Democrats to unseat. Donald Trump. Yeah, there's a limit to how much you can draw any conclusions that are relevant to us here from the British experience.
You know, and when you look at polls, polls are not anything that's finite or exact. They're snapshots in time. But when you have 8 or 10 different polls, all say basically the same thing, which is whatever top 3 or 4 Democrats run against Donald Trump, it's going to be a close race. This is nothing like what happened in England. Nothing at all.
No, absolutely not.
And it's a fear tactic, and I'm sure it backfires. But getting back to Donald Trump, with this latest, I don't think people realize how serious our allies are going to look at what happened with Donald Trump once again replacing a major, major person in his inner circle, so he doesn't get correct information. That has to scare the bejesus out of our allies all over the world.
And delight everyone who's trying to wreak havoc, like perhaps Mr. Putin in Moscow.
It's amazing. Now we can get on from this because I want.
By the way, while we're in the same circus ring, as it were, we mustn't leave out of the equation for this portrait of the caricature of Banana Republic again. The president, of course, has this extraordinary power to pardon and commute the sentences of convicted criminals, and he's done so with a whole bunch this week. And what do they all have in common? Oh, friendships going way back with the president himself, and popular broadcasting and other kinds of fame, and gossip column fodder, and they're just the kind of people that you just would not be surprised that Donald J. Trump would want to pardon. Leading the procession, in my mind at least, is Bernard Kerik, the former commissioner of police in my current hometown. Bernie Kerik was sent to jail for tax fraud and for lying to Congress when he was got to the point of he got to the point of being nominated for the position of secretary for Homeland Security and had to withdraw because he knew about all the skeletons in his cupboard that would come tumbling out once he was put through a vetting process. And as I say, went on to get sent to prison also. So what a bunch of people. What a bunch of people to be associated with our chief executive. But all part of the same scene. By the way, Bernie was the author of a book called The Lost Son, A Life in Pursuit of Justice, which his own publishers described as an astonishing story of bravery and honor. Now, the publisher of his book was a woman that he had a secret affair with, one of two simultaneous affairs he had with, and conducted both of those affairs in the same in the same apartment overlooking Ground Zero in Lower Manhattan, which was meant to be used by workers at Ground Zero, who, when they got so exhausted by the long hours they were keeping, they needed somewhere nearby to take a rest. For people who are genuinely brave and heroic, it's the tackiness of this man's later career. And some of my details, I have to say, of his earlier career boggle the mind. And yet, yes, he's in the bunch of people who've been pardoned and sentences commuted by this fine president of ours.
You know, every one of our presidents have done pardons, and just about every president has done a controversial pardon or two.
For sure.
But,
yeah.
But
I mean, it's in the personal gift of the president. So, of course, it's bound to have a certain aroma at times.
But
this is a particularly ripe example this week, huh?
Yeah, not as many in 1 week. Well, get away from that for a second. I want to get to the debate, and I hate to call it a debate because they're not debates. They are forums. They are forums that all the candidates were in. At the end, I didn't watch it. The next morning, I watched a lot of compilations, and I watched a lot of interviews. Former advisor to Barack Obama actually got on an MSNBC anchor. The anchors were saying, well, you know what really got to us is we don't understand why Democrats were fighting Democrats and not mentioning Donald Trump. And he came out and said the thing that I was thinking the minute I heard this. He said, they weren't the ones asking the questions. They were answering the questions that were put to them by the press. It was such a ludicrous statement. Everything they were responding to were from questions by the press. Why didn't the press ask more questions about Trump? You know, what's your feeling about the coverage of the press of the on these debates? And as a matter of fact, how they ignored Bernie for 2.5 to 3 months, and all of a sudden when Bernie became real, the mainstream media is on it, and people like Chris Matthews openly calling for his defeat. It has to make you shake your head when you look at this.
Oh, I do more than shake my head. I bang my head on the desk. they're not covering themselves with glory, I'm afraid. I'm a little twitchy about the forthcoming debate, if that's what it is, and I rather agree with you, it's a dubious term, in South Carolina. There, I think there will be six candidates, and CBS, who's the hosting broadcaster for that one, is fielding five moderators.
Unbelievable.
I don't know what kind of clarity they hope to emerge from that situation. So just in the sheer mechanics of it. But yes, the questioning techniques, too, leave a lot to be desired. A lot of it is about gotcha journalism. It's trying to phrase questions in such a way that you'll end up with some kind of quotable quote that gets you the headlines you want. That's a reasonable enough game to play, but it's degenerated into these very transparent efforts at creating booby traps. Since the main object of this entire process is to select someone to go head to head with President Donald J. Trump, you would expect them to be asking questions about what they have to offer in contradistinction to the president, and indeed that fundamental question of can they really expect to beat him? That's a theme that needs to be central. And of course it's not. It's all about encouraging internecine warfare, which would be happening anyway, of course. I mean, the candidates have to knock each other out. It's a knockout process, after all. But just to go into the business of currying even more internal wrangling They seem to think it's their purpose. Many of the moderators, anyway, seem to think it's their purpose to ginger up what's already a competitive process between the five or six serious candidates that are on the stage.
It's if you Google Morning Joe later on today and go back to it once again this morning, and this is what gets me mad about the press. I won't say the press, about television, mainstream media press. On NBC this morning, they're pushing the idea of a brokered convention, anything they can do to prevent Bernie from getting it. But also, they have people that just are out there calling Bernie a socialist, not a democratic socialist. A couple of the guests said all he is a man who screams, and he's a deranged. Basically, they make him out to be a deranged individual. And it really crosses the line between personal opinion and news. Now, one thing I'll give to Brian Williams the other night at 11 o'clock.
Oh, we crossed that line a long time ago with Fred Marshall.
You know, and that's
the worst part of this form of journalism, not being aware of the distinction between what is known and what is known in a consensus kind of way, and what the flat out opinion of the questioner is. That's a fundamental principle of journalism, certainly in my mind, and in people who pursue the kind of journalistic tradition that I do. But that's been thrown out of the window long ago.
You know, I was
especially on cable television.
It's amazing. I'll give Brian Williams credit. The other night, Chris Matthews went on one of his rants and basically calling Bernie a communist and stuff. And when that report ended, Brian Williams got on and said the following: "Well, that is the opinion of Chris Matthews." He tried to lighten off, you know. He tried to lightly say, you know, hey, that was, you know, a little overboard. But I just shake my head because the media hasn't learned a lesson in 4 years after 2016. The politicians and the political parties haven't learned anything since the ascension of Donald Trump 4 years ago. And there is no playbook for what's happening now other than being a true politician, a true voter, a true human being. And it appears, and a true news media, and it seems like all those things have been just thrown out the window.
Yeah, that terrible phrase, post-truth society, seems to be getting more and more apt for what we've devolved into, I'm afraid. Sorry to be so dispirited myself. It's been a dispiriting week, as I said at the beginning.
You know, you think back to the 60s and what people thought was going to happen, and even to the 70s, and this country has almost turned back the clock by about 40 years. It's scary.
Uh-huh.
It's scary. That's all I can say. Because it's a worldwide problem, David. It's not just here in America.
Sure. I was alluding to that earlier. Yeah, Britain's no better, and of course, countries from Hungary through to Chile in the southern tip of Latin America, it's pretty much the same kind of syndrome with local variations, of course.
And it doesn't leave time to talk about the coronavirus. It doesn't leave time to talk about some new immigration rules that have been instituted in England. I mean, there's a lot of unbelievable stories out there that can be covered by.
And they also, just that short list that you did, they all. It sounds familiar, doesn't it? I mean, there's so much replication in some degree right across the globe. India, just to say one word, India,
yep.
Also. There'll be another time for all of that.
All right.
I'm glad to have talked today.
Well, David, I appreciate it. We love your commentary and your insights. And once again, people can find you at themediabeat.us. And we'll speak to you next week, David.
Look forward to that.
Take care. That is David Terechuk with the Media Beat here on Robinhood Radio.